college. I guess one learns when you, after screening a great number of cases of circumstances which no one ever anticipated were going to happen. I mean, the putative father or real father taking a child for interference with custody, takes a kid in for plastic surgery to change a kid's appearance. I know these things seem far-fetched, but I guess for the basic reason that probably a lot of divorced couples have relied upon a decree in which they agreed to share responsibility for major decisions, and we're basically setting aside that agreement absent any real showing of a need to do so.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Brennan.
Well, unfortunately, we just live in a litigious society anymore, and it affects everything we do prior to making all kinds of judgments, whether it's me as an optometrist or as a member of a public body. It's affecting the treatment, no doubt about it. And they've come forward with a situation here that obviously is affecting the treatment of children, and whether they receive timely treatment in some cases or not. And when it's come to this point, reaching us here at the Judiciary Committee as a problem, I believe a problem exists, whether there's been actual cases or not. Nevertheless, it's affecting treatment. So I'm willing to take an up or down vote on it, and I support it.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Brother Cummings. Senator Brockmeyer.
I don't suppose that there would be any problem here if we were to attempt to circumvent the problem, and I had certainly not thought of what Senator Springer just brought up about a parent, a non-custodial parent taking a child in and having his or her features completely revamped so that the mother or the father could never find that child again. I mean, that is a rather drastic measure, I would have to admit, but could we put something in here that would say, like, emergency care or something like that, that you know, if it, you know, where you really wouldn't have any problem with that basis, or would that be too limited, or what? I think it's a good compromise. It's just a thought.
Well, I suppose you could. I'm not sure you want to say life-threatening, but certainly emergency care, and the profession would understand what emergency care was versus some routine.
I mean, there would be all kinds
thing.
Of.
I don't know who's going to. I think life-threatening is a little bit too far.
Well, there would be all kinds of counseling involved if you were having plastic surgery, I would think, and some other things. But I mean, you give them some pamphlets on lactation, perhaps, or something.
That's right. And it wouldn't include that. Okay.
It's just a thought. If there
what
are
do we think about emergency care? Is it worth going through with the bill with that on it? I mean, I think that's probably. I guess I'd ask what Ed thinks about that.
Well, Madam Chair, I would. The requesters of the bill were looking for something a little broader than that, and my guess is that under the current statutes, emergency care it would be permissible with or without parental consent.
Okay, thank you. We are probably down to the up or down on the bill.
Madam Chair, before we decide.
Senator Brinsky?
I don't recall. Was there testimony that at the present time that treatment may be held up until a second parent can be contacted? Are we not treating children in some cases, or is it just kind of something that people worry about?
Well, I gather what you're hearing is that there is, and I've just been handed a note that there is a statute that deals with emergency care situations. So that's not a compromised position that we ought to be looking at or need to look at, I would say, in more specific terms. So. That's where we are.
But there wasn't any testimony that
we had one testimony, one person who came to testify. Okay, let's proceed with
move
yes.
The bill.
Yes, Senator Brennan
do
is
pass.
Moved. Senate yep. Bill 832 is the due pass.
We moved the dash three.
Oh, excuse me. I guess we didn't. Senator Brennan has moved the dash three amendments, and we're going to probably have a vote on the amendments. Are there objections to the amendments?
Can I just note one other thing?
Yes.
One thing I didn't mention the amendments do, and they move this out of ORS 30 into Chapter 109.
Which is?
I believe that's the domestic relations chapter. The parent-child rights section.
Are there objections to Senator Brenneman's motion? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay, now we have the bill before us, and Senator Brenneman moves Senate Bill 832 to the floor with a D-pass recommendation. Pat, call the roll, please.
Brenneman?
Aye.
Brockman?
Aye.
Brensky?
No.
Hill? Shoemaker?
Aye.
Springer?
No.
Motion carried. Thank you. Okay, let's move on to Senate Bill 592. Senator Brenneman will carry that bill. 592 is the bill that we've had a lot of debate about it has to do with support and actually custody of child.
It's the homestead exemption.
Yeah, liens.
And the, correct, and the amendment was requested by the committee so that the state couldn't get into the exception. And we also listed in the amendment the ORSs that are affected or that come under where the judgment liens can be obtained, the judgments and the judgment liens can be obtained.
Beth Mason is here from Washington County. Do you want to give no more than a minute and a half reminder to committee about what?
Well, she's come forward. May I ask counsel a question, Madam Chair?
Yes, please.
I think I understand the purpose of the language there proposed, where we distinguish between private parties, but not an agency of the state. Is there anyone who can tell me whether or not the state has or would be prevented by statute from, say, assigning or selling off its interest, say, at a discount to a collection agency, a professional collection agency, says, okay, we have this indebtedness that we're owed, we'll sell or assign to that agency that obligation to be enforced by that agency and thereby remove it from this distinction? I don't know if there's anybody who can answer that. I don't know if the state that does that now, but states like any other debtor, I assume, creditor, I assume on occasion they may feel free to contract out collection of their debts or may sell those debts to be collected or assign those debts to be collected by somebody else.
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, Carl Stecker, Marion County Deputy District Attorney. Essentially, the purpose of the amendment was to call out those debts which are strictly assigned to the state, not the debts that might be owed to private individuals, yet enforced by, in effect, an arm of the state through the district attorneys.
I can try to restate it. Whether or not you, the DA, or the state can, quote, in turn take this assignment, reassign it for some consideration.
No, there's an express prohibition on assignments at the end of Chapter 25 that prohibits assignments of child support to any for collection purposes and so forth. You cannot assign that right.
Okay. Thank you.
And we do have Terry Rogers, who from Legal Aid, who has sent us a letter and contacted us, saying that they are opposed to the bill on the principle that they don't believe that the homestead exemption ought to be breached under any circumstances. So I just, for the record, need to share that with committee members in case you haven't received that communication or it hasn't come to your attention. That is a change of position from the last time Terry Rogers was here, testified in favor of a narrow consideration of the bill. And we now have before us a choice that says for child support purposes, you have a right to breach the homestead exemption and request that the property be sold. And correct me if I'm in error in stating that, Beth.
No, that is correct in terms of stating their opposition. Essentially, what they're doing is they're suggesting that the adult private debtor has a superior position to the child private debtor. We're suggesting that child support should take precedence. And Legal Aid's position is that there is no precedence at all over the homestead exemption, that the adult private debtor should be protected at all costs.
This may have been covered, but can someone give me a ballpark figure of what it costs? What are the transactional costs in terms of trying to foreclose, attorney's fees, other costs related to this?
It's generally, there's the costs of the sheriff's fee for the actual writ of execution on the home, then the advertising costs and the publication, well, advertising publication costs. And the attorney's fees generally run $1,000 to $2,000. And at the end, you get a sheriff's sale on the steps of the courthouse, and the judgment debtor can bid their judgment as if it was cash. If the homestead exemption is in place, they actually have to pony up cash to buy out the homestead exemption before they can bid the first dollar of their judgment, or the sale fails.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Grinsky.
I'm wondering, I like to collect these things. You know, I'm Mr. Collection. But I'm wondering if we're almost hurting ourselves with this thing, because the person has to be able to continue with a life in order to have an income and to pay delinquent child support. If you take away that homestead exemption, I'm wondering if you're just basically not forcing him to send up a white flag and leave the state or whatever, and then we'll never collect the money. I'm wondering if it's not just a public policy argument of letting people live in a house, but it's also a thing of letting them continue with some kind of life so they can pay their debts. What do you think about that?
I guess my concern is one of balancing interests here. When you purchase a house, you essentially have a tax-protected savings account. Okay, you are building equity in that home. You get to take a tax deduction for your payments. And by this statute, the first $15,000 of value in that home is protected from anything, including your child support obligations. When you compare that to the collecting spouse, generally the parent who has the children, who is probably can't afford to buy a house, is living in a rental, is getting by on probably less than $1,800 a month, which is generally what these women are trying to get by on, pay their child care costs, pay their food and clothing for their children, what you're saying is that the parent that has the ability to own a house gets to maintain their lifestyle at the expense of the other parent who can't afford to own a house. And I think that we're not saying you can't live, just as when we garnish you wages, we're not saying you can't work. We're saying you have some obligations here that you must meet, and you're not entitled to this protected savings account at the expense of your children.
Do you think this would actually be used?
I think so, but quite frankly, as a practitioner, I think the way it will be used is this. I think that the execution will be noticed.
Just be a lien, and then when the...
And then the sale will be started, and the owner of the house will pony up the money rather than lose the house. I don't think you'll see very many sales, but I think as soon as it's at risk, the sheltering of income that we're now seeing is going to come to an abrupt halt.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shoemaker, Terry, you want to come up?
Before you would go after a person's home to collect on a judgment, I assume you would have gone after everything else that person
has. Absolutely. Wages first.
So
wages.
You've got their wages. You've got their car. You've got...
Not usually a car. Cars are very hard to collect against because there's an exemption for cars. The first $1,500?
$1,200
for cars.
All right.
And generally, there's a debt against a car.
Security.
And by the time you sell it, you just don't get much for all your trouble and the expense associated with it. You have to, when you pull a car for execution, you have to store it.
These people don't have a car that's worth very much anyway.
No. And if there's wages, you'd never go after a house, because a wage garnishment is by far the cheapest, easiest, cleanest, best way to get cash in the pocket of the...
So by the time you reach the house, you've really pretty well put the guy on the mat. You've got everything else that he's...
Interesting. There's one little piece about this that I'm going to interrupt as chair and say that the one that I've had most trouble with is that people call me, and they are people who do not have wage garnish, who don't work for wages, and they're builders and they're people.
There's the self-employed element.
Who are self-employed people, and you can't get any garnishing on anything, and yet they have a fancy house, and they're not paying the child support out of spite, and to some degree, they're also some of the folks that you're going to go after with respect to some of this house.
They got a fancy house, you can get that except for $15,000.
But you have to have the cash to pay them the first $15,000. The person who holds this judgment actually has to have $15,000 cash to hand to that person, or the sale fails. Because if there's not enough cash out of the sale to pay off the homestead exemption, then the statute says the sale fails, and the person who initiated the sale has to pay all the costs and gets nothing. So it is the self-employed person, quite frankly, that we have the most trouble collecting money from. It's extremely expensive. You know, you try for bank records, they change their bank accounts. You try for attachments, wage garnishments, or garnishments against people who owe them money. You know, you've got someone building a house, so you go to the person that they're building it for, and you garnish them. But you can't get a permanent garnishment in that situation because they're not an ongoing employee of that person. I know from my personal experience, I've spent thousands of dollars of my time, because there's no justifiable way that I could bill it through to my client, trying to track down some of these guys and dig through their records and get their assets. And the self-employed person is virtually collection proof, the way our child support collection is set up right now.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Terry.
We have switched. Thank you very much. Terry Rogers from Legal Aid in Multnomah County. We have switched from the adult against the child to somebody who is self-employed and has a luxurious home. I would just like to point out that Oregon has an extremely low homestead exemption of $15,000. Other states have as high as $40,000. And that's the amount that is protected. A lot of the people that we are dealing with will be people with second families, and we will be making them destitute. So that I think that, in fact, we ought to just maintain the policy of a homestead exemption as low as it is, and if there is this fancy residence, then there is additional equity in it. There is plenty there.
Okay, my question is, Terry, how do I borrow the $15,000 to, and must I borrow the $15,000 from somebody before I get to the sale question of being able to sell it and receive the proceeds from whatever, and I guess that's the problem, I think.
Madam Chair, I would suggest that we meet and take a look at where they know there's additional equity in the home over the $15,000, enough to pay off the debts, that then we look at some kind of change with regard to that, but so that you don't have to come in with the money. Legal Aid spends most of
that. We're looking that really stands in the way.
Then
of doing
let's
it.
Work on that. I am not prepared with an idea now, but I would be happy to work on that.
Okay,
Madam Chair.
Senator Gritsky.
There's nothing keeping you from getting your child support judgment, and that judgment then would become a lien in the county where the real property is situated, right? Do you ever contact the mortgage companies and let them know that there's a lien on the property? Because most mortgages, that's a breach of the term of the mortgage, and they can actually accelerate and make them go get a new mortgage or make them clear the lien off. And I'm wondering if you've ever explored that. It'd be an end run around this homestead exemption thing.
Quite frankly, Senator, I have not. It strikes me that most mortgage holders, as long as the lien is inferior to themselves, except in the area of taxes, because of the foreclosure, the way the taxes work and can take precedence over a mortgage, they don't care, mm-hmm. as long as it's inferior.
A lot of times they don't find out about it, though, because they don't keep running a title search every month to find out if
there's Well, I don't want to debate this. If the I'm ready to go with what the committee wants to do, and I would send them back to try to see if we can do this. I honestly believe that the $15,000 would be an impediment to anybody trying to retrieve any piece of property.
I would like to work on that, because
and,
of course
because I couldn't come up with somehow borrowing $15,000 if I had a lien on the line, even if the house was eventually split out at 150.
Madam Chair, I think there would be a way to deal with that, and I think they're on the right track to go out and figure out what it is. I mean, you could get the house in a position where the foreclosing creditor could arrange for the sale of the house and have this whole thing kind of like in an escrow, and the foreclosing creditor gets the right to sell the house over some period of time, 6 months or so, and then out of the proceeds of that sale to a third party would pay off the homestead.
Yeah, I want to remind us, we're going to be creating very special class creditors here, and we're going to bring in all of the financial institutions, and if that's possible, that's fine. I just think we might be you know, we're going to stir up a great hornet's nest by trying to change some of those well-established procedures, but...
Excuse me, Madam Chairman. Senator Shoemaker, with all respect, I think that you, at a foreclosure sale, there's usually one bidder, the person who holds the judgment.
I know that.
So even if you give this exclusion somehow or another, that the first $15,000 of proceeds goes to them and then they can sell for the balance, there's no other buyer.
No, my point, Mason, was that the buyer at the foreclosure sale would normally sell the house.
Turn
around and sell it. So you kind of put everything on hold and give that person an opportunity to do that, maybe 6 months, to either sell it or borrow against it, whatever it takes to be able to pay the $15,000 over to the former owner, rather than having to do it on the spot.
There's a problem with that. I know we don't want to stay on this, but realtors don't like to even try to sell a house if that screwed up.
Mm-hmm.
Title companies, banks won't loan on it because title's that unclear. I think there could be problems with it.
I'm willing to set them off and we'll bring this back next time we meet for work session. So I want to bring it back right away so that we have it fresh in our minds. I'm not prepared to have the same debate we've had before, you know, again, at the next work session. Either they come in and say, we have some agreement that we think will work, or we'll vote up and down on the bill as it stands before us, and we're not going to spend a lot more time on it. But if that's the pleasure of the committee, I think we'd like to, you know, delay it a little bit and see if we can't work out some reasonable way to...
Are we talking about approximately a week, Madam Chairman, or...?
Oh, no, it's going to be quicker than that. I suggest if you've got time to work on things a little bit today, it'll be next week, probably Wednesday. We'll bring it back Wednesday next week. Because we should resolve it.
Do you have somebody in mind that you can talk to work this thing out?
I can stay right now.
I mean, real estate law, why is it sort of...
Well, I do real estate as well as domestic relations, so I'm familiar with both sides.
Okay. We'll work it out. Thank you very much. Thanks for your patience, committee members, on this. Okay, we've got a transfer. Catherine's going to go away, and we'll have Jack come, and we'll take up the next bill would be, let's take 1134, since that's the crime prevention bill. It's on its way to Ways and Means, and Judge Thornton is here. Jack, do we have amendments to...
Yes, we do. We have one relatively minor bill amendment. I'll pass it out to you now. There was a discussion, you'll recall, from or a suggestion, I believe, from John Potter, who is the executive director of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, to add in the Criminal Defense Board as representatives on the council itself. And I believe Judge Thornton took that as a friendly amendment. And that's what this LC draft does, which is 1134-1, dated 4/21/89. The bill itself, you'll recall, Judge Thornton, as well as Representatives Hostica and Gold, I believe, testified about the need for some organized crime prevention programs, and that's basically what this bill does, is establish the council to oversee that.
Madam Chair, would you like a motion on the amendment?
Yes, please. Senator Springer has moved the amendment 1134-1. Are there objections? So ordered.
I believe the bill is amended to pass.
Senator Springer moves Senate Bill 1134. And does this go to Ways and Means?
Yes, it does. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Do pass to Ways and Means is the motion. 1134 as amended, moved by Senator Springer. Discussion? Call the roll, please, Pat.
Brenneman?
Aye.
Brockman?
Aye.
Brinsky?
Aye.
Yeah. Shoemaker?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you very much. Let's move to 832. Is that next?
284
was next. My undone stock, and it's at the top of the list. 284? Are we ready to do
284? Just before 835.
Okay, yes. Well, let's do 284 then.
I mean, I don't care, but...
No, that's fine. I've got something crossed out here. 284.
Senate Bill 284 is at the request of Joint Interim Committee on Judiciary for the State Court Administrator. This is the bill that we just heard on the 12th that Mr. Lemon characterized as a housekeeping bill. He did submit some amendments, and I'll have them for you here in just a moment. These are Mr. Linden's amendments that have been through LC that basically make some relatively technical changes.
Great, thanks.
I think you signed it. I'll check.
And Mr. Linden is present. Should we need some additional explanation?
Okay, what are the effects of these amendments? Bill, you want to come up and tell us? Or Brad? Whoever's...
I think he's out in the hallway.
Okay. Unless you want to go through yourself?
I would prefer that Mr. Linden did. Briefly, I can tell you that... The amendments, among other things, take care of some problems that were that resulted in the drafting process primarily. One of the things they do is make a little bit more clear when indigent defense counsel needs to get pre-authorization for expenses at the trial level. It also addresses some confusion as to when a person who is not indigent at the trial level is entitled to appellate counsel. Mr. Linden, in his written testimony, points out that there are some cases where the person, in fact, becomes indigent because of trial expenses, and this bill, or the amendments, I believe, make clear that even though he may not have been indigent at one time, if he is at the time of the appeal, then he's entitled to appointed counsel. And those are the primary thrust of the amendments.
Okay. Senator Shoemaker? You satisfied with the amendments?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think I had a problem with the bill.
Okay.
Not sure.
Anyone else?
I understand it. Was there any opposition to this? Was this a bill that somebody said it thought it was a lot more than housekeeping, or was this a better bill?
Thank you. Well, I don't know.
That bill that Justice Lindy and Justice Gillette...
Oh, no, that's 305.
No, I don't believe there was any opposition to this one.
That comment was made regarding that bill, but not regarding this bill. Isn't that right?
Okay.
Senator
Springer?
I'll move the amendment.
Okay. Senator Shoemaker has moved the amendment, Senate Bill 284-1. Senator Springer?
I don't know if we ever found Mr. Linden or who prepared
well,
these.
Well, apparently he left out.
Okay. So. Well, I see, for example, on line 11 of the dash 1 amendments, provides on page 4 after line 10, after reasonable, we're inserting and necessary. But there's just above that on line 6, we talk about reasonable compensation. I don't know if we're distinguishing here compensation or we're... If necessary, is because we're speaking in terms of expenses instead of compensation.
I think that's true. Okay. Necessary expenses rather than reasonable expenses. So you're adding, in the expense classification, you're adding reasonable and necessary expenses.
Okay. There must be a reason they want to do that, but I guess to control costs, I assume. So I guess we want to encourage that. Nothing further.
Excuse me.
Jack?
The reason there is testimony in his, or a passage in his written testimony that addresses that, and it simply says it adds language to conform to the requirement in trial courts that authorized expenses must be necessary as well as reasonable.
Are there objections to the amendments? So ordered.
I move the bill as amended.
Okay. Senator Shoemaker moves Senate Bill 284 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Call the roll, please, Pat.
Kendall Brennaman.
Aye.
Bachman.
Aye.
Bransky.
Aye.
Aye.
Springer.
Aye.
Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. I'll let Senator Schumaker carry this one.
That was coming. I'll never do that again.
That's part of how it works. If you want to screw it up, it's yours.
A lesson there.
Okay, Senate Bill 835, without Lyndon. He wasn't here.
Senate Bill 835 is also at the request of the Judicial Department. There are no amendments. This is the bill that had to do with the form of criminal judgments. You may recall that Dale Penn came in, and there was some discussion about shifting or reallocating the responsibility to do criminal judgments. There was a meeting in my office between myself and Brad Swank and Dale Penn, and basically those parties came to an agreement that perhaps now was not the appropriate time to pursue that, and Mr. Penn agreed that the bill should go forward as it is. And this basically establishes form requirements for criminal judgments and gives the Attorney General authority to be involved in that area.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 835 forward to due pass recommendation.
Senator Grinsky has moved Senate Bill 835 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. It is on demand.
I would like to see that a law at the same time. There were some amendments, and do you have those amendments?
Catherine would have them, or she's going to get them, so we'll pick them up in a minute as soon as she gets back. I don't see them in our files yet, so they're probably either on the printer, or it looks like Catherine's going to go retrieve them. Senator Schumaker.
Maybe while we're waiting for her to return, you could give me a quick education on justices of the peace. I have to confess I'm from city, and I'm, of course, generally aware of justices of the peace, but I don't know much about, you know, what all they
do.
I
want to remind you, we've got another big
I know
piece
that,
here.
But we have a whole bunch of bills, and I kind of like to know what justices of the peace are all about.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, justices of the peace have concurrent jurisdiction with district court judges, the civil limits being somewhat different, and there is a bill to address that. District courts are now set at $5,000, civil jurisdiction, justice of the peace at $2,500. As far as criminal cases, their jurisdiction is concurrent.
What education do they normally have when they take the post on?
To sit, there is no qualification as far as education at this time.
What do you find as a matter of practice? What disciplines do they come from?
Well, they come from many backgrounds, but there are more and more attorneys also becoming justices of the peace. And in my own situation, I was a contractor prior to becoming the justice of the peace and attended the Judicial College located in Reno. And that's really where I became familiar with the justice system.
And I take it that they hold court, as it were, in many small towns and communities, but not generally in cities that have a district court.
There is only one justice court located in a city where there is a district court, and that is in Tillamook. And there was a special statute to permit that. Normally, the justice court is prohibited from operating where there is a district court.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Here's a big sign built down in Lancaster.
Do we have amendments, Catherine?
I don't have any.
We have amendments on Senate Bill 413 somewhere around here.
I have not seen them, Senator. Did you bring them in, or?
I did not bring them, but I did receive a copy from Senator Brockman that showed that they had been.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll track them down before we have a work session, so.
Very simply, they're very simple. The amendment simply was, instead of reporting to the Special Courts Advisory Committee, it would be to report to the Commission on Ethics, Judicial Fitness. And that made sense. And so those two changes in line 6 and also in line 9. And
Okay.
I think that would...
Yeah, we'll...
Oh, no, the other amendment also had to do with the timeframe. And at this time, it says 20 hours per year. The amendment would be 30 hours per biennium, which is the same as stated by the Bar Association.
It's the same as the Bar Association, then? Okay.
30 per biennium.
Very well. Let's move on then to Senate Bill 415.
Senate Bill 415, and I'm Judge Edgar again from Chulalongkorn, Oregon, representing the Justice of the Peace Association. As the statute now stands for contempt powers for justice of the peace, the maximum penalty that allowed under the statute is a $25 fine and or 10 days in jail. In my testimony, I had recently a case in which the defendant was somewhat unhappy at appearing at trial, and so indicated with his middle finger to me, later bent over and pointing to his lower end to the officer who had made the citation originally, and used some foul language, and I think it was somewhat ludicrous that the maximum I could fine him was $25. I'm asking that we delete that language and allow the justice courts to have the same contempt powers as the district and circuit courts. Yes.
Yeah, and we have a bill on contempt powers later.
Yes.
On today. Senator Springer.
Could you remind me again, Judge, what are the maximum contempt powers that a circuit judge has?
Circuit judge, I'm not familiar with. District judge?
Or district judge.
Okay. Depending upon the types of contempt and so forth, and I'm not sure of what the maximums are, but I believe it's 1 year in prison and a $2,500 fine.
Madam Chair, are you, Senator?
Excuse me, one year in the county jail. I said in prison. I'm sorry.
I think I might prefer to deal with this issue in that larger contempt bill. There are questions about that, whether in the circumstances the judge described, and I appreciate the situation he's describing to us, but whether or not he necessarily ought to be the one to make the decision about punishment in that situation, I think there's a certain degree of sensitivity in terms of how a court exercises its contempt authority when the judge may be perceived to have less than a totally objective point of view.
We'll
take a look at it and see how it fits with the other contempt, and we might be back. We'll be back to work it around a little, maybe with you, to sort of get some halfway point. Maybe.
If you increase the penalty that much, I think you'd have to offer the person a court-appointed attorney.
I agree, and I think that happens, Senator Springer, in indirect and direct contempts and so forth. But $25 fine just seems antiquated to me.
Senator Grinsky.
What happens when you want to put them in jail for 10 days? Don't they get a court-appointed attorney there?
If they so would like one, yes.
Were you able to sentence this guy to some jail time?
Yes, I did.
Oh,
he did not want a court-appointed attorney, however. He was offered, but he did not want one.
Well, I would think just...
And I did not, however, sentence him to 10 days, only 2 days.
Well, that's pretty stiff, don't you think? I mean, I'm not saying that it wasn't appropriate, but it's not something that you take very lightly either.
I agree. 10 days.
Okay. Any other questions? Let's move on to Senate Bill 417. good. They're in a manila folder. They're real. They're not even fake ones.
I don't know if they're enough to go around. They ended up in my...
I know, they never run.
Okay, why don't you go ahead, Judge?
Okay, again, Judge Edgar, representing Chiloquin, and simply on Senate Bill 417, in lieu of Senate Bill 646, I would move to table 417.
Okay, well...
The changes that I was asking are included in that other bill.
Well, I don't know, but everybody's got the file before.
Are we in work session? Oh, okay, then let's go ahead and take Senator Brockman. Would you like to move?
No, I never moved to table my own bill.
We're just checking with you, see if it's okay with you.
It's perfectly all right with me. What's the number?
Wait until he leaves the room, then.
Senate Bill 417.
417, I move that we table Senate Bill 417. If indeed we are in a work session, which we are not.
Well, we can't, we aren't, it says possible.
This is a possible, okay.
Since the requester has suggested we table it, we'll do the first...
Take him at his own word.
Yes. You'll call the roll, please, Kissing.
Aye.
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 All right, motion carried. Thank you. Let's move 418.
418?
18.
Judge Edgar again, Senate Bill 418. Which simply asks to increase the civil jurisdictional limits to $5,000 in justice courts. In view of the fact that our small claims limits are at $2,500 and our civil limits are at $2,500.
Okay. So you think that when was the last time that's been changed? Do you recall? Do you know that? Do you know?
I don't know. I do not know.
I remember about 10 years ago we were all debating it, and then we decided they were all going to go out of business, so we didn't bother too much with them, and then...
It's been at least 10 years.
Yeah, I would think.
Previous to that, I don't know.
Any questions? Senator Springer.
This means there'll be fewer cases filed in circuit court then?
I suspect, Senator, that there should be fewer filed in district courts. If there were a district court in those areas and so forth, I think this bill would mainly help the jurisdictions in the eastern counties where there are fewer courts.
Okay, if we're taking many cases out of the state court system, we're going to have an impact on filing fees, which may or may not have any significance. I think our friends on the other side have already created or recommended creation of two new district courts over near part of the world, as you may know, Lake now here in Kearney County. But, yeah, that's it.
They do that every session, too, don't they?
Senator Springer. I mean, Shoemaker.
Brennan, Brockman, Shoemaker, Springer.
Question.
Is a case filed in small claims or justice of the peace court removable to district court at the motion of the defendant?
I think so. You can get into a court of record, I think, pretty easily if you want to.
It is. Senator, are you going to make questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think we have taken care of all of the items on your list. Is that right?
I also had Senate Bill 416, but I don't know if it was scheduled for today.
Did we miss the right one? Wrong one? Well, why don't you...
Do it.
No, I think that... Unfortunately, we can't. It's not posted. We may have posted the wrong bill and posted 417 when we meant to have 16. I don't know. I think that was true. Well, why don't you leave your testimony with 416 and... I'm sorry about that. I didn't realize that it was. You'll have Senator Brockman.
I'll send Senator Brockman a bill.
To masquerade for you at the proper time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I've been to Reno.
Okay, let's move on to our last bill, Senate Bill 287. We have two people, and this is the contempt bill. And talk about complicated. It's a bit complicated.
Way too thick.
I don't think any bill should have to take it off the people.
Well, it's 3 minutes to three. The judge, Paul Lipscomb, was
asked to be back at 3 because that's when you would get back.
He was asked to be back at 3, and we're actually 3 minutes early. But we'll go ahead on.
We table it.
Are we scheduled to go to 4 today?
Yeah.
And so I do have judiciary, I mean, labor, maybe, probably no point in my even getting started on this one.
Well, I think you better hear as much as you can. It's fairly complicated.
But we've been given strict instructions today to be down there at 3. So I know we're going to have to leave, yeah.
Will we be
returning? Well, let me tell you what, the problem I'm having is some relative frustration with gathering our committee members. Excuse us for a minute while we're in this waiting period. Next week I'm told I'm going to lose a portion of committee members almost every day. Grinsky's gone Tuesday night, which was scheduled to be a big work session night, and
Brenneman and
Brockman
are
going. Which days?
Friday.
Oh, Friday only?
Well, no, Thursday too, but we're not scheduled to meet on Thursday, so it's
okay. So we're gone. We're losing you on Friday, so that leaves us
and Brenneman.
Real short next Friday, and we get into some heavy work sessions. There are things that you want to have some say about, or that you better, you know, it's real hard when we get into this kind of situation with people missing a lot. Okay. And we are
let us know what's up as soon as you can. And we'll,
yeah, I just want to say that it is somewhat frustrating.
I understand.
I wouldn't have agreed to leave for Tuesday night, but I didn't know at the time that we were going to be meeting on Tuesday night. I made my arrangements to go for this thing a month and a half ago before we were meeting at night.
Well, let's just we have someone from Bend signed up on this too. So why don't the two of you who are here go ahead and we'll start through this and
okay.
We'll do the best we can.
Let me explain to you what you have in the package in front of you. You have, first of all, written testimony from Judge Lipscomb, which I will read because he was to be the presenter of the testimony and the bill for the Judicial Department and the Judicial Conference because it's a judge-type bill. Secondly, behind that you have proposed amendments in the package. Behind the proposed amendments, you have a hand-engrossed copy of the bill showing the proposed amendments. Behind that, we have written a memo to your counsel explaining the problems with contempt, the theory behind the bill, a section-by-section breakdown, and what the amendments do, the effect of the proposed amendments. And I guess since Judge Lipscomb is not here, I'm not nearly as good-looking nor distinguished as the judge, but I will give you his testimony. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am submitting this testimony on support of House Bill, of Senate Bill 287. I'm appearing on behalf of the Oregon Judicial Conference and the Judicial Department. Senate Bill 287 will standardize contempt practice and tie various existing statutory contempt treaty proceedings into this new standardized practice. In addition, the bill will make contempt a more effective tool for courts and parties. Contempt is a procedure a court uses to enforce its orders, protect the court, and protect litigants from and compensate litigants for wrongful acts of others. Contempt is not just used by the courts. In many statutes, contempt is a way to enforce state agency actions. Contempt is also the procedure used to enforce restraining orders in domestic violence cases. The primary problem existing with contempt procedures is that the current statutes are confusing, do not correspond with case law, and do not provide basic procedural information necessary for courts and litigants to use the contempt power effectively. Senate Bill 287 will help clear this confusion and fill in many of the procedural gaps. Senate Bill 287 does not expand existing contempt powers, which are part of the inherent authority of the courts. Rather, it explains and establishes procedure for how contempt is used. Most of the provisions of the bill are specifically authorized under current case law or statutes, but these existing authorities are often difficult to find and use. This is why courts and practitioners need a roadmap to find their way through the contempt maze.
The Judicial Department is submitting amendments to the original bill. Some of these amendments are in response to questions and concerns from judges and others to make sure that language is clear, that the procedures in the bill are helpful, and conflicts with constitutional requirements are minimized. The amendments will also simplify the bill by eliminating some procedures and requirements suggested in the original bill. The original bill was very ambitious in trying to raise and resolve issues about how constitutional limits apply to contempt. The Judicial Department has concluded that some of these issues have not been sufficiently resolved by the appellate courts to allow codification of the constitutional requirements at this time. The amendments remove those provisions that attempted to resolve issues where the constitutional limits have not yet been determined. What would remain would be standardized, would be the standardization of contempt and the simple procedural steps necessary to inform judges and parties how to proceed in a contempt. As amended, the bill would allow judges and parties to know their rights and responsibilities and would provide for notice to parties of the potential procedures that apply to contempt. These improvements over current statutes would help solve problems that exist in contempt proceedings today. Finally, I would like to say that most judges do not regularly use their contempt powers. This bill will probably not significantly increase the use of the contempt power, but will make it more and a more effective tool when resort to it becomes necessary. It is in part because of its infrequently used power that the standardization of its procedures would be most helpful at this time. In short, this bill will benefit both the courts and those who practice and appear before them. For that reason, I recommend this bill for your favorable consideration and thank the chair and committee for your time and interest. Normally, I would not read testimony to you, but this is a procedure that this is the testimony of Judge Lipscomb on the bill. He was originally to have been the presenter. I am here to answer technical questions about the amendments, why the bill was drafted the way it was, the origin of the specific provisions in the bill, if you need that, or any other kinds of questions in relation to the bill. The Judicial Department, as Judge Lipscomb says, is simply trying to draw a roadmap of contempt procedures so that people who use contempt have a map that they can follow in the statutes.
Madam Chair?
Senator Shoemaker.
I do need to leave very shortly. I'm wondering, is there any opposition to the bill? And if there is whoever is to speak against it, could they give us whether the opposition is technical, that is having to do with details, or whether it's fundamental? If I could learn that before I go, that might help me when I sit down to read this.
And let's hear from D.A. Hallett.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, pardon me. When were these amendments available?
We have been working with the District Attorneys Association. We have been working with other people who have commented on the bill, trying to resolve issues and to work on them. We finished the amendments at 12:45 today.
Okay.
And I was up until almost midnight last night working on them to respond to questions that people had and concerns that they had. They make substantial changes to the bill. They back out many of the issues that were originally in the bill, because those are not issues that there are constitutional guidelines sufficiently established that we feel we can put them in statute and address the issue. And if we've missed, you're smiling. If we've missed something, I mean, we're trying to draw a roadmap. So because so many people have so much trouble with contempt and with using it and getting into court on it and finding out what's going to happen. So the amendments were finished literally 15 minutes before your hearing time today, and that's why it took so long.
But I don't mean to suggest any criticism of that process. I think the endeavor is a noble one. I just am concerned that we have some amendments which fairly change the substance of the bill that were just available today, and there's little opportunity, if any, for people who might be affected or might want to comment for the amended version. I mean, they virtually have no notice.
Well, part of what we're doing here is trying to get something together.
Sure.
So people can have comment. They've been working with the original bill, and people have been critical of the original bill. I've directed Catherine since the very beginning to be in touch with our local circuit court judges, and they have commented in their areas that they have, in fact, deleting from the bill because they have, there's no clear understanding about how it's going to be you know, implemented or how it would work and how far you can go. I guess I'd like to hear, before Senator Schumacher leaves, let's hear from what the district attorneys have to say, and then we'll...
That's great. Just two quick suggestions. We may want to get this thing printed and grossed before we bring it back for next work session.
Oh, well, I wouldn't. Look, this is not what we're going to have a quick work session on.
And I'd be curious to know whether or not the Oregon State Bar practice and procedure that people are in court as litigants have had a chance to review the amendments.
The amendments. No, they haven't.
Okay. I think their input would be helpful to me.
Enough said. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Dwayne Hallblibe. Also, I put it on the list there, known as Tony Hallblibe from the Deschutes County District Attorney's Office. I represent the Oregon District Attorney's Association here today. The bill, as you have it before you with the hand and gross version and the proposed amendments, we support. I will say in questions that you had before, and Mr. Swank's aware of this, we did not support the bill as it was originally proposed. And we've worked out, as late as he said, at the 4-1 today, the final solution of that. And I think that once this becomes an A and gross bill, with these changes, we do support it. I'd just quickly like to say that basically what it does, the way it stands now with the amendments, is codify existing law, which any of you have ever practiced in the area of contempt, and as a child support collector, I do a lot of practice in that area, and it's a real maze the way it is. I've had judges in who there's specific findings that you have to make in order to get to certain levels, and I've had judges in sitting pro tem who've just said, when I've asked for those findings, well, I'm not going to do anything further. The guy's in contempt, and that's it. You just sit back and roll your eyes and say, I hope he doesn't appeal it, because if he does, I'm going to have to try it again. This law would change that, and it would require those findings that are now there by case law. It sets out clearly, I think, a roadmap, about as clear a roadmap as you're going to get through the maze of contempt the way you have it before you now. I don't see any fiscal impact of this bill at all. You're going to be doing the same practices. Matter of fact, one of the sections in there, if anything, may drop, may lessen fiscal impacts. I think that one of the problems that I have in child support collection is the tools to collect are to a certain extent limited. Contempt has been a good tool to collect child support, and I think this greatly improves that tool. I think all of you are well aware of the tremendous amount of child support arrearages in this state, and as child support collectors, we need every tool we can get. We do support that bill the way it stands with the amendment, and I would be happy to come back at any future work sessions to discuss the ins and outs of it, because I realize what your time is like. Thank you.
Thank you. I have one basic question, I suppose, and it's important. It would be important to ask the judge, and I'll ask the district attorney, and we'll want to ask the other practitioners. If we embark on codifying current practice, now, is that enough? I mean, are we going to want to continue to work on this and rearrange the entire process in a more profound way than just sort of codifying what we do now? Is there a need to go beyond this next session? I guess the question I would ask, are we just responding with an amended bill because we had a bill in the first place, and is it something we need to go back and work throughout the interim to actually retool and change the processes appropriately? So I guess that's my bottom line question to you as a practitioner.
Hey, Madam Chair, again, from the standpoint of practicing in it, this bill gives us an excellent roadmap and pulls together all of the loose ends that appear to be out there and gives the judges that same kind of direction that we currently don't have, because the case law is scattered here, there, and yon, and many of them don't have the time basically to go read it. I think it would make contempt a much more useful tool. I will not be so naive to sit here and tell you that there's not holes in these kinds of things, because they are. There's things that none of us can anticipate that are probably going to be raised somewhere down the line. And the the bill, this is not the first time we've discussed contempt before the legislature, I think.
I have my own note that says, didn't we have this last year?
We had this one last year. I had the very great misfortune of in front of a committee, I think, with Senator Springer on it one time when he was in the House, of having to tell a judge that he had just testified to your committee and he had testified about law that was not correct. I guess that's one court I probably don't want to practice in after doing that. But yes, this is, that I know, we've been looking at this for well over 4 years.
I think Judge Harrell was around in 85 with a fairly comprehensive approach that was somewhat stillborn.
Right.
That was the judge I had referenced to, Senator.
Judge.
Hi, I'm sorry I'm late. I had kind of thought that...
Just introduce yourself for the record and we thought we were going to be late.
I'm again. Paul Lipscomb, District Court Judge here in Marion County. And I just talked to Mr. Swank and he indicated that you've already had my testimony read to you. And I certainly appreciate his doing that. And I, again, apologize for being late. And I'd be happy to be available for any questions other than what was set forth in my written testimony. I don't have anything particular to add at this point, unless somebody
I'd ask the same question I've asked, and you probably missed my question. And that is, with the amended version,
yes,
is that an improvement over the current system, and is it satisfactory to go ahead and try to make some, to codify the improvements, codify the current practice now, or is the problem or the nature of the problem such that we ought to just not do anything this session and try to again work on something more comprehensive? Or I just want to be sure that the amendments are not just here because we say, oh, we've drafted a bill and it's too complex and we run into some questions and some people who aren't sure what it means, and so, well, let's just draft some amendments which codify current law and we'll go with that. I guess I need to know how serious we are with these amendments. I mean, is it worth working on the amendments or will it help?
That's a compound question, and let me give you the easy answer first. Yes, it will help. I don't think it will hurt. And the reason for the amendments, or at least those that I principally suggested, was to take out language that could present some problems in the future and language that raised issues that potentially raised conflicts between this branch of government and the judicial branch of government. Frankly, the problem, from my perspective, with the bill before was that it was too comprehensive and did get a little bit too detailed, and I had a real concern as to what would happen if a litigant who was unhappy with what happened in a contempt